Hey everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, your weekly dose of insider DevOps trends, AWS news, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our SweetOps community, plus a live Q&A you can't find anywhere else. It's July 17th, 2024. I'm your host, Eric Osterman. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We are a DevOps accelerator for funded startups and enterprises that helps companies who are overwhelmed with AWS. And we do this by leveraging our over 200 Terraform modules that we've combined into a reference architecture that you can have today. So if you're curious to find out more, have questions, or your team's struggling with Terraform for any reason, just reach out to me at cloudposse.com/meet. Again, cloudposse.com/meet. Answer a few quick questions and we'll chart a roadmap to success for free. So how can you maximize today's session? Real easy. Our format is informal. Ask questions, raise your hand, and if you're curious about any of our open source modules or tools like Atmos, this is a great place to ask those questions. You can join us live every week by going to cloudposse.com/officehours. Again, cloudposse.com/officehours, and we will be posting a recording of this session to our YouTube channel. So if you want to share it with your team, you can do that easily. Just go to youtube.com/cloudposse. All right, so let's get into some news and announcements. The big one that I see trending everywhere is a announcement that Google has entered into an agreement to acquire Wiz. Wiz is one of the top security platforms to ingest all of your resources that you have deployed on your cloud provider of choice and identify misconfigurations against various compliance standards. What's interesting is I believe Wiz was only started a few years ago or 4 years ago by some ex-Israeli military people, and they grew this to such a large company in such a short time. Unbelievable. Anyone have experience using Wiz or more to share about this? That said, since it's Google acquiring them, expect a sunset notice in about 2 years. So if you are on Wiz.io, you probably want to look to move off. Just kidding. But I don't know. Google just seems to sunset everything.
I was thinking the same thing, Eric. How long until it's killed by Google?
Yeah.
And I guess equally important, would they be willing to kill it after spending $23 billion on it?
Right. Maybe they're doing it for themselves. So if we pay enough money, we will not want to sunset it. So they have more skin in the game. Who knows?
I
It's a
thought
cycle.
Google Domains, not to digress to Google Domains, but I thought that was just a moneymaker for them. But apparently they got rid of that. They sold it off to Squarespace. But yeah.
They did. And how apropos that you bring that up, because let me refresh this here. There was an incident related to that. Honestly, it seems like a lot to do about nothing. And why is this not loading my slides? Go figure. Let's try this again. There we go. All right, so going back here. So there was news actually related to the Squarespace acquisition of those domains. Did I add it here? Oh, you know, I didn't even add it here because in the end, I thought it was a lot to do about nothing. But apparently they were not doing sufficient levels of authentication when it's registering for your new Squarespace account. If your domain was transferred. So there were a number of domains that were hijacked as a result of it. But it would still send an email to your inbox. So to me, that's the same as every other service that does log in via email. So I don't see it as less secure than all these other mechanisms out there. Does anyone have more insight into that Squarespace incident? Here's the Squarespace incident. I'll share that one too, since it wasn't in the notes. Yeah, so basically, if you had access to the email address and that domain was transferred to Squarespace, you could then hijack that domain. But I think that's pretty much true of most registrars if you have access to and do a password reset. And if that email address doesn't have MFA, well, we learned that lesson, right, from Snowflake. You got to make sure you have MFA or you are in a bad spot.
Yeah, as you described, it sounds like a whole lot of nothing. I mean, like maybe an attack vector, but I wasn't across that. I migrated off after having one domain migrated, not by choice, but it was not. I've personally migrated over to Porkbun, like a Cloudflare, I guess, a reseller that's been working out okay. But
Pork bun?
yeah, Porkbun. There's probably other ones out there. I just liked some of the security features that they offered, but they're a little newer on the block. I'm worried they might get acquired and get killed. But so I did. We host all of our zones in Route 53 or like Google Cloud, but I wanted to keep the DNS registration separate, and this worked out pretty well. I think we're actually looking at Route 53 for all of our domains, like a separate AWS account for it. And then we ran into the issue of .dev not being supported in Route 53. And so rather than having two different registrars, Porkbun kind of checked the box for a lot of it. Plus, you end up getting the benefits of Cloudflare name servers without having to set up a Cloudflare account and everything.
So,
So if you
interesting that they don't emphasize anything about Cloudflare here. Like reading this about us page, I wouldn't trust them for a second. We're awesome because we're awesome, and you should totally use us. But if you know if they're a reseller somehow for Cloudflare, that adds something. I'm curious though. That was my plan. I was going to move everything we had that was on Google Domains over to Cloudflare because I would trust that. But then you have to have the authoritative name servers on there, which precludes really using anything on the TLD top level domain on like Route 53, where we would want to use it for automation purposes. So, does this get around that?
yep, we got bit by that when we registered some brand new domains in Cloudflare. And it caught me off by huge surprise because I've never seen that from any registrar. But it's legally allowed. Cloudflare can do it. So just got to read terms of service. And shame on me for not doing that. But yeah, so you're locked once you register a domain, and you're stuck for like 90 days, as you imagine, when you just register a domain. With Porkbun, we have not had any issues like that. You're registered with Porkbun. They've established a partnership with Cloudflare. So early on, they were self-hosting their own DNS. Naturally, that's, as we all know, that's usually a bad idea. And they had outages a couple years ago. And then since then, they migrated into a partnership deal with Cloudflare. So I think they have like some partnership type of account, is what I imagine. And you basically can use them for your DNS. We don't use it. We don't use Cloudflare through Porkbun for any for anything critical. So like if we can tolerate a minute or two of downtime between switching zones, we use Porkbun. If we are doing anything that needs HA, we have the hosted zone on Route 53 or another cloud provider. So converting into, for example, cloudposse.com, your top level domain might be on Cloudflare today. If you want to migrate it to Porkbun, you are going to have some downtime because you need Cloudflare to deactivate something on their end, and Porkbun can do all of that, but it's like it's some weirdness on just that migration and its initial cutover, and then after that it's smooth. We're yeah, and then you get DNS sec and everything through there. It supports you don't get proxied records. That's probably the biggest thing that's missing. But if you
That's
request it, they might see two requests because I've requested proxy records too. So at least I know they can add it. Well, at least that's my understanding. They can expose more records, but they choose not to. They're not trying to compete, I think, directly with Cloudflare and have all that functionality.
I don't think I'm sold, so I won't be making any moves just yet. But I had never heard of Porkbun, and I thought it was interesting that you
I
went to
was
Cloudflare.
looking at, I went down Reddit digging for a bunch of different
Oh, okay.
And
Got it.
two things I wanted was be able to call someone and have someone have a US-based company. I was recommended Gandhi.net as the alternative back then. And when I opened up tickets with each of the vendors, Porkbun was the most responsive. And they also had a phone number and they're all US-based. So that was a huge selling point. Whereas Gandhi.net could not, I had to submit tickets in French. And even then, it took a couple of days. So that was a bit of a challenge. But I digress. If you want to get back to
That
the
is
announcement,
interesting.
feel free.
Very cool. Anyone have something to add to the discussion before we move on? All right. Oh, and I forgot to hit send on that other link. So there's that link. Oh, it's not wanting. Oh, I'm trying to send out to the group here. Where's the group? All right. Next announcement. A small one, only interesting if you are a Kafka user. Managing your partitions in Kafka is something you can obviously do with infrastructure as code. Maybe if you're just doing some local development or trying to manage your partitions in a less mature environment, a TUI text-based UI like this might be nice. Interesting. GitHub is aggressively not allowing me to scale this up. There we go. Yeah, just an easy way to navigate. Again, this is part of the recurring theme on office hours that text-based UIs are making a comeback in. Another utility along that those lines. Next one, I forgot to study up on this one before the call. Matt, did you have a chance to look at the Radius attack? No. So Radius is the authentication protocol used in a large number of VPNs, network appliances. It's integrated into the Linux operating system with PAM, I believe, and countless other mechanisms. Well, there's some attack that's threatening this now, and you can only imagine that it has. There's a lot of tech debt out there that's going to be affected by this. But I unfortunately I can't add anything because I didn't. I read it earlier this week and don't remember. Jonathan?
I do have a little context on that. One of the reporters is a Boston company, Bastion Zero, which is basically one of these will help you manage access to your data center companies. They were recently purchased by Cloudflare. We were talking to them about maybe doing a POC. It says, you know, one of the things like a strong DM or teleport app or that sort of thing. But obviously a great pickup for Cloudflare with not only a kind of a fancy cryptographically more secure protocol for that type of access, but also a high profile break of the longstanding protocol.
This was uncovered by Bastion Zero.
Yes, that's part of the team that reported it.
Okay. Yeah, I see there. All right. Next announcement is a similar hack that CISA, which is apparently some new sort of task force that was set up to do more serious penetration testing, apparently without the limits of previous efforts like this. They can penetrate multiple organizations under their charter at the same time, while previously arrangements only allowed ex the penetration teams to only target one organization at a time. This ability to be able to leverage different organizations against each other apparently makes it easier to identify realistic attack vectors that they were also able to exploit here. Now, they leveraged a 0 day when they were commissioned to do this that had not yet been announced. However, even after it was announced, the systems weren't patched for 2 weeks and they were able to maintain their access for a full 5 months. Fortunately, these were friendlies. You could imagine other using those same exploits might not be as friendly. Next announcement is another pass. There's obviously a plethora of these out there and can't go over all of them. It used to be everyone associated with Heroku, like self-hosted Heroku, like DAIS back in the day, DEIS. That I think has unfortunately gone away. There's Doku, which is a very simple pass, self-hosted, not for scale, but just for convenience. And now and now this here. So they're billing themselves as
Eric,
a, yep.
I think you're not sharing your screen. I don't think so.
Really? According
Thank
to
you.
me, I have the green line around it.
Really?
Matt, you might have clicked a new tab in Zoom
Oh,
that hides everything.
I don't know. My
Yeah, I
fault.
see it.
Sorry.
User error.
Okay, user error on me, but somehow I just see all the people, but not your screen, which is really weird.
At the top, there's a tab that says meeting, and there's another one that says Eric.
Interesting. Yeah, that's what happened. Sorry.
And
I just didn't want you not to be sharing on the Zoom. It
no, I
just
appreciate it.
happened, and I didn't think I touched anything. So sorry for the interruption. Continue.
I only know that because I've done it many times, and I was really confused for the first week I updated Zoom.
Yeah, well, this is that's the other thing that we bring up every week on Office Hours. The latest breaking changes on Zoom, no pun intended. And this week's changes, there's now tabs in Zoom. So check it out. And if you don't see them, you're running an old version. Or you're the host like me and I can't see that either. All right. So this pass called Tau, by the way, really nice job on the README here. I spent a lot of time designing READMEs, so I thought this was a clever usage of images. Each one of these images is an image in a table, and they're using it like an image map back in the old days. So you can click on one of these and go to specifically that part of, well, this is not so nice. Some of these I were clicking were taking me to the relevant sections. I guess they're still working on it. Anyways, don't have anything more to add to it other than it looks like it has a pretty convenient CLI to interact with it. And it is open source and self-hosted. And I believe they offer or will be offering a managed version as well. This time, though, I don't have information on that. All right, next one. I don't know how this is even possible. This is crazy. There is using WebAssembly a virtual machine written that you can load entirely in your browser, which I got immediately really excited about. It's kind of like a dev container, except for there are a lot of major limitations with this. In order to get any networking, you have to connect it with your Tailscale network. And there are some practical limitations that mean you can't really go above 1 or 2 gigs for these images. And basically, just to get the VM working, it's 1 or 2 gigs. So I think there's a ways before this could be used for like tutorials and things like that. I got really excited because I was hoping this is awesome because this would be another way we could make it easier for developers to kick the tires on Atmos without any local dependencies. Just that there's no networking, so that's not helpful. And you can't really run Docker in Docker with it. And it's limited to 1 gig or 2 gigs, depending on how it's invoked or something. That said, it does work. You can click on it, and it was a little bit slow. Let's see here. What was the link for it? Yeah, I don't remember where I saw that link to try it out. just this WebVM. Yeah, there we go. So you just go to webvm.io and you're dropped into a shell. It's a little slow, but it works. Very restricted, of course, in terms of the overall runtime environment.
Can you install Tmux?
Well, even if you did, well, yeah, no. Is this app? Is this Debian? I didn't see where it was. What's the
It's
OS?
Debian.
Yeah.
Oh man, it's taken a while.
Yeah, so I didn't get to play with too much, but most of the commands I ran were pretty restricted or not able to run. So I'm sure there are a lot of caveats to using this yet. Still very impressed that I didn't realize WebAssembly was this flexible that you could build a VM with it. All right. Next announcement. All right, so Amazon has come out with a new agent that you can operate that sits in between your services and Amazon Secrets Manager, which, by the way, is also an API. The arguments here is that it's re reduces server-side request forgery for security perspectives, adds caching, adds which reduces latency. So if you are heavily using ASM for secrets, I suppose the caching part is nice. Can someone help explain to me how this protects against the server-side request forgeries? Because I don't understand how you would you. To me, just the AWS APIs alone do that by post-based requests that need to be signed. So I don't understand how this adds an extra level of security. No takers?
I'm trying to think of how it could happen, and I don't understand how it. How it helps.
Like IMDS V1, wasn't that the thing that was vulnerable to this kind of server-side request forgery? And then IMDS V2 came out, which pr protects against that, which I understand by it being post requests that I believe need to be signed.
Yeah. I mean, in order for it to help you with the SSRF requests, basically would be saying that I think that the web server that you or not the web server, but the API that you're calling would have to be vulnerable somehow. I'm confused by the statement there.
Let's see here. I'll have to upload. Okay, I'm just curious if this is one of those generated. It's exceptionally verbose for a and a paragraph written, so it makes me think that this was just written by AI. Twenty 21% confidence. All right. Not high. Anyways.
I actually have a couple of thoughts just really quick about this. Is one, well, there's two things. One is that I don't believe there's any revalidation. So once it gets cached, if or like there's no cache busting. So once it gets cached, if your local instance can return stale credential data,
Highly likely.
until the cache is restarted, I guess. That's one. And then two, it seems to me that you're now storing secrets that are accessible anywhere on the machine that this is running on. So you now have another thing to secure so that people like rogue processes can't steal secrets from this other process that's running on the machine. Like imagine, you have, users on this machine, right? Like that are somehow caching these credentials in memory. So it seems like another possible attack vector that could be there.
Yeah, I'm just not getting it. Not understanding. Well, I would have understood if this was like an AWS Labs project, maybe really early in development, but this is under the main AWS GitHub organization.
Yeah. I mean, this is almost like essentially writing, you're running a Redis instance and then just storing all your secrets in Redis, and then getting them there because it's faster. Like, I don't quite understand how this is being a good steward of the secrets. So maybe I'm misunderstanding something.
And the announcements doesn't have more information really. It's just a very short two paragraph blurb about the service.
Yeah, that's all I saw too, and I didn't have a chance to actually dig into it.
See in the chat here, did someone add something?
They do make references to the SSRF token within their GitHub repo. Unfortunately, I am not across the benefits still, but if you were to read the README, might find some more details.
Yeah. All right. Next announcement was an interesting write-up. There's a company that is building lots of Docker images. I forget what their use case was, but they didn't need the full support of, I guess, the Docker, the OCI registry protocol. So they're exploring ways how can they speed up these builds. Docker image pulls are very much optimized for the pull aspect. Those can be done in parallel. You'll see that when you do a Docker pull that it's pulling down all those layers, certain number batched and the percentage. Uploads, however, have to be serial. So building and pushing images is very slow. So what they were able to show it, as a proof of concept is that if you don't care about maintaining perfect OCI, compatibility, you can actually upload the layers to the deterministic paths in an S3 bucket, and you can do that in parallel. And it's radically faster. The problem is that you can't use the Docker push command or anything like that. It's only a pull-only ability to do that. Also, they did some research where if you were able to, I mean, the only reason why ECR is so slow is because it is enforcing that sequential upload of layers. So I was trying to research this a little bit, and I didn't understand why OCI has this requirement that layers must be uploaded sequentially. Can't one layer just refer to the former layer? And if the former layer doesn't exist, it's just not ready yet.
Yeah, I think the way that the protocol works is it's basically just it's a 404. If you can't find that layer, it errors. There isn't like a wait for some period of time for that layer to exist.
Yeah. All right. Anyways, thought that was interesting. I've wondered the same sometimes if one could just do that. The same is true, by the way, of the Terraform registry. You can just put everything in deterministic paths on an S3 bucket, and it will just work with Terraform. You don't need to actually run a registry server. And last one to me seemed more like hypeware. Amazon announced some App Studio that promises, which is a big word that I don't believe yet to help in a no code fashion, basically just through prompt engineering of develop enterprise type applications. These are applications that work right with your internal systems and so forth. These kinds of things always leave me with more questions than answers. And, what if we want to start, what if we start that way, but now I want to start using our own libraries and our own, code? Can I do that? And, can I keep updating it this way? And, and so forth. I think we will be there. I think we'll get there in like years from now. I don't think we're there now. I would hate to put something like this in the critical path of the business. Jonathan?
Yeah, so I've been using Copilot and then Cursor, which is like Copilot plus plus. In fact, I think that's the feature name. It just intersperses brilliant with, oh my God, that's so stupid. I can't imagine. I mean, I know it's all the hype. I cannot imagine realistic programs being written today, even with the best, Claude 3.5 Sonnet or the best open AI models. I mean, just my own experience from using what is supposedly the best tools and ones that are kind of on the edge. They are brilliant. When they're brilliant, they're just great. I love them. But if someone's going to put their entire app development required to be right for the entire app, I think that's just folly.
Yeah. So can you tell me more about Cursor? I hadn't heard about that.
Cursor is like a ver it's a version of VS Code that is based on the same VS Code code base and with the same compatibility. But its version of Copilot is much better for doing inline changes. Very often I find, I change one line, I decide to do, more logging in one section of code. I go to the next section. It's already decided that I probably want to add that additional logging on all the other key operations, and it suggests it. And I just press tab, and it drops it in. It has a lot of compared to Copilot, has better accept or reject semantics as well. So it's a very nice tool. I'm very happy to have it. But just like all these AI tools, even when they're brilliant, you have to have real clear oversight.
And another subscription. Anyone else using Cursor or kick the tires on it?
I'm not, but I'm using a different thing.
Using
I'm
what?
using Super Maven. It's
Super.
yeah, it is a like a much a much faster like Copilot experience. Like what that illustration that they're showing you there is like pretty like accurate to how fast it is to do code completions and things like that compared to Copilot, which seems like unbearingly slow compared to now that I've used the Super Maven for a while. So
And it's a plugin for your VS Code.
yeah. Yeah.
But and another subscription, of course.
Yeah, that's what I said, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The
But
number
it's got like
but AI, it's interesting because it's not like I have like five subscriptions to accounting software or chat services or telephones. But when it comes to AI, you end up subscribing to this, to this, to this, and there's so much overlap. It's interesting.
yeah, I'm mostly like not like that impressed with Copilot, and it's to me over time it's become worse, which seems like the opposite of what the intention is. So I've been trying to kick the tires on a bunch of different tools, and I will eventually probably settle on one, but until then I'm going to continue to try different things to see how they work. Like this one's been the most promising so far for me.
Yeah,
Although they're
you owe a book report on at least two or three other services you've installed in our GitHub organization.
I do.
What's that one, Rabbit AI or something?
Yeah, so that's like an AI pull request, an AI pull request reviewer, essentially.
What's the current coder rabbit? That's
Yeah.
oh. Looks like another back.
Cloudflare. That was weird. Yeah, I think at scale, like this would actually be pretty good. Like I found the comments it made and the suggestions it made to actually be pretty legit. I didn't try it with a broad set of things. I tried it on a very narrow thing purposely because I didn't want to install it on a million different things. I only installed it in one repo here or there. But I was pretty impressed with its ability to look at the code and then summarize what its thoughts were on what you should change as part of that pull request.
Anybody have success with this or similar code review platforms?
We're using Codeium, and it works pretty well. I think self-hosted if you wanted to. They use ChatGPT on the back end, so they're using OpenAI on the back end. I think it's Codeium.ai. Yeah, that's it.
I remember seeing this one before. Very
But yeah,
animated.
have any strong opinions on it? Definitely look at the comments, and I've definitely gotten some helpful things out of it. But yeah.
All right. Someone brought up Tim in the chat here. There was a AWS announcement. I think we forgot to cover or did not cover. Let's see if we're clicking it up in the right window. Introducing Amazon GuardDuty malware protection for Amazon S3. Interesting. Yeah, that's been a void in Amazon for a long time. I remember there's this small SaaS service that built a product around this and did pretty well. So now finally, Amazon brings basically virus scanning to S3.
I wonder if they charge you for every read that the virus scanning does of your S3 bucket.
Probably. I mean, they must have like a team just at Amazon dedicated to how do we increase utilization? How do we increase? Jonathan?
I just want to say I've been recently kind of overwhelmed by security services calling me to, pitch this or that new feature. And every one of them, of course, wants a minimum of $15,000 or $30,000 a year. And then I look over at my Amazon bill for GuardDuty or Cognito or whatever, and it's $100 a month, or it's and yeah, one of them that someone pitched me on a big commercial service is $4 a month. So it's I am not going to say that the Amazon WAF, the Amazon GuardDuty, et cetera, is the world's best malware protector or what have you. But when it comes to doing security reviews, some of these Amazon services that are add-ons are absolute godsends.
They at least let you check the box.
They absolutely let you check the box. And, if I had to buy for $30,000 or $50,000 a pop every individual service that these things, there's absolutely no way we would be going without. GuardDuty in particular is a great investment.
Yeah. Feel you there with the costs of all these services when you stack them on to each other. Tim, was there anything else you wanted to add to that one? All right. Well, now we can get into some Q&A. Any questions that we can get answered today? All right, I'm just going to go top to bottom here. I just see Aaron.
Hello, can you guys hear me?
Yep, we got you.
So I believe AWS recently announced this AWS Secrets Manager agent, which purports to be a client-side HTTP service to allow things like a Lambda in our use case to ingest Secrets Manager secrets without requiring an SDK integrated in the Lambda function code to retrieve those secrets. So it's some sort of like a sidecar process, not a sidecar container, but some sort of a sidecar process that cache that retrieves secrets and caches them and makes them available, I guess, in the environment of the Lambda. If you Google AWS Secrets Manager agent, it'll probably be the first.
Just to be clear, we did talk about this at length today. If you joined late, maybe.
I'm sorry, I missed that.
No, what was there? No, that's totally okay. Was there?
Oh, I'm sorry. Right. Yeah.
But
My question is.
what we struggled to do was identify, like, why is this even worth introducing into the environment? We struggled to come up with a strong case for that. Do you
I
have
see.
it?
Well, I don't want my secrets in the Terraform state. And if possible, I want to obviate the need for the development teams to integrate an SDK and rely on all of them to integrate an SDK to retrieve those secrets every time they run a Lambda. And also the performance improvements. I mean, it caches these things at the initiation of your Lambda function, your Lambda function instance. So I think there's some performance benefits. Are those not good values for this use for this?
Well, the one thing is it doesn't just expose it to your environment. You actually have to make an HTTP call to a local endpoint to retrieve the secrets.
So you do
So,
need an
like,
HTTP client in your function needs to be there.
yeah. So, like, to me, six of one, half dozen of the other.
I
Like,
see.
if I have to call it, maybe the caching, if you're making a ton of calls, maybe the caching is truly beneficial. But, like, I also think, the way, at least, I don't know about on Lambda, but I looked at how it works on EC2 instances and in containers and everything, is on startup, it launches an HTTP server locally. It writes a token to disk in a specific location, and then a user has to be in a certain group, like Unix, group to be able to then read that secret, and then you have to use that as the authentic in your authentication or in your request header as an authentication token to be able to retrieve secrets. So it doesn't seem like this is just like some simple plug and play thing. This is like you got to do a bunch of stuff to make it work.
Thank you for explaining that to me. That makes it seem in more in perspective.
Yeah. And
And
then I was questioning why, like at the end of the day, like,
okay, yeah, like not any easier than just having an SDK retrieve those secrets.
probably easier to have an SDK retrieve those secrets because just use the SDK. It's fully documented. It's not another thing you have to operationalize, not another thing you have to deploy, not another thing you have to upgrade to the same degree. I mean, it just
And
baffles me.
in Lambda in particular, the SDK is built in, so you don't even have to like
Exactly.
transpile
Thank you
or
very much.
compile it inside. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So
Thank you.
ah, sure thing. And then Foursquare Beetle.
Hello.
Hello.
Can you hear me right?
Yeah, we got you. What's your
Okay.
question?
So I was asking about Kafka. I want to ask about if someone has deployed Kafka in Kubernetes, because I was facing some problems with Kafka operators lastly, and I didn't manage to deploy it. So I want to ask.
Yeah, I've used Streamzy operator. Which operator are you using?
I used one called. Sorry, Bankata. It wasn't about Kafka. It was about Cassandra. Sorry, it's not Kafka. It's Cassandra because I want something alternative to DynamoDB, but somehow open source to deploy in my local stack. And I was searching and I found out that there is Cassandra, CillaDB, and there is what we call the one. Yugabyte or stuff like that, the name. So,
I have not done Cassandra, but my general understanding of running databases or data heavy workloads in Kubernetes is you basically have to make the same system level optimizations that you'd have to make outside of Kubernetes, like file, you have the same file handle limit issues and have to make system like OS level changes. So if by chance those are the issues you're running into, you may have to update your worker node pool to reflect that.
Can I
Is
isn't
get back though?
isn't that the job of operator to do that for me, or I should?
Don't believe the operator will handle the operating system level optimizations. I think because of the access that the operator has, I don't think it's, I don't, unless you're running like a privileged container, I don't believe it'll be able to update those settings on your operating system. A lot of times you like bake it in when you're bootstrapping your node, is my understanding. I'm trying to think of a particular example. Sorry.
Optimizations are not universal, though. I mean, it's like people say, "Well, can't you just deploy me a SOC 2 compliant infrastructure?" And it's like, "Well, which standard do you want?" And then there can be competing options depending on the services you use or the benchmarks, etc. Just like with optimization, are you running a cluster that is only going to be running this and nothing else? And to what degree are you going to do it? So let's take a step back instead. What do you want to get out of a DynamoDB like service? And do you need the scale and the performance
Okay.
or SQL aspects of it?
Okay. So, like, yeah, I was doing a challenge with myself. I was somehow taking an architecture of AWS and trying to, transform it into all open source product. I mean, like, I'm taking SNS. I'm trying to find the open source side of that and try to deploy it on my cluster. So I will show you. Just the architecture, I will send the link. I mean, it was, or let me send you the blog. Can you open the image?
Yeah, hold on. Excuse me. Ah. So this was the
Yeah, so that was the architecture. So I was challenging myself to deploy each one of the services, but with the open source. I mean, I'm trying to find, let's say, an example, Lambda function. So I'm trying to use Knative on that. API gateway, I'm trying to use Kong or Ambassador or any open source one on Kubernetes. For Cognito, I'm trying to use Hydra, the Aurai product. So I'm trying to deploy the same architecture, but in open source alternative way.
Understood. But every question begets another question. So, is the reason just because you do want to you want to demonstrate that it's possible using open source things, or you want to literally recreate this architecture without paying for AWS? Because if it's the latter, you can just use local stack probably for every single thing here. I'm not sure about Bedrock, but
I don't know
Bedrock
about local
probably
stack,
not.
but yeah,
That's the
I'm trying to get more comfortable with the Kubernetes, so I'm just
okay.
trying things, yeah, here.
Oh, I got you.
Okay. I don't know. So as you see here, DynamoDB, you see in 2.9. DynamoDB is here used for saving data, and then there is streaming, change data streams. So it's stream data, data to Lambda function. And yeah, so I'm trying to find an alternative way to do that. Cassandra was, I think, the first one that comes to my mind. But yeah, the installing is so painful, and it requires, I don't know, XFS or stuff like that. It's complaining about that.
If you're looking to just do like a POC, I'd recommend trying to grab a single container version of these services versus doing the operator. You can usually get something running quickly. For example, running Postgres single container without an operator is super easy, but deploying like crunchy data or another PG operator type solution, there's a fair amount of complexity involved there, let alone some network challenges depending on if you're using an overlay network or not. So yeah, depends on what your goal is. If it's for production, I'd probably lean with Eric on this of using a managed service. But if it's for fun or for a POC, like a dev environment, definitely recommend just going the single container version. I mentioned Streamz earlier. That's for Kafka. I don't really recommend it. It's a pretty good thing, but if you're for running like a serious workload, it's having played around with stateful workloads on Kubernetes. I'm not really a fan.
I already installed Streamz for deploying Kafka because Knative needs a topic or a message broker for handling the event thing. So Kafka was the first thing that they recommended on the documentation. I'm not facing a big problem now, but I don't know. Maybe
it works. We didn't have any outages. It works, but there's yeah.
For testing, everything works, but. So one last question will be that SNS, if have anyone so any alternative product on that. I saw Novu. I don't know if I pronounced right. It's Novu. It's yeah, like that. It's yeah, that one, open source notification infrastructure, but they don't have an integration with Kubernetes, and there is no Helm chart. Even the Docker the container thing, it's not that easy to understand. And there is a prize. There is a prize. It's a good project, but it's not the same as SNS. It's I think it's like it's handle adding multiple notification systems like SMTP, I don't know, email, stuff like that.
It's a little hard to make, since it doesn't seem like you're going for like API compatibility with AWS services, you're looking for conceptual alternatives. I mean, then you have AMQP, Rabbit, and you know, there's a wealth of these kinds of systems that are tried and true, and you'll find operators and charts and all of that for.
Okay.
And this one doesn't provide SNS compatibility, does it?
Yeah, it provides, I think. Yeah, it
provides.
SNS compatibility.
Well, no, this probably this that that's a provider. It can probably send to all of these different systems. It doesn't provide an SNS API.
Yeah.
So different.
It feels like you're taking on a big project, but if you figure out the alternative, I am definitely curious on what you come across and what you end up using.
You've kind of done something like
yeah,
this.
Yeah, I'm doing a video. I'm doing a video, inshallah, about it. If the time I finish it, yeah.
Yeah, so, in our repository, in our repos, we have a better description, but we're primarily using like Loki, Prometheus, and we're staying pretty far away from some of those heavier stateful workloads. But yeah, pretty similar, probably worth an offline conversation for us with Beetle.
Got it. Yeah, I just know you've gone down the route of self-hosting a lot of things so that you could have like a cloud agnostic solution, and the challenges with that.
Databases are hard. So we've kind of kicked the can on that for now, and
That makes
steer
sense.
people towards using RDS or something that comes with a DBA for free, basically.
Yeah. All right, last question, Jonathan.
Yes, I don't want to make this the open secrets manager agent all the time show, but the whole kind of secrets manager, secrets, some local agent, local vault. Is there, I just want to get a check-in. Is there a preferred or kind of golden solution for handling this problem of local secrets? I mean, is that vault slash OpenDAO? Is that a magically delicious solution, or are we just all kind of making attempts at because there really isn't a great magical solution these days?
Yeah, I don't have the answer to that. I'd be curious, what is the state of open source secrets management platforms? Vault being obviously the one that everyone knows by name, and then OpenVAO being the fork of that, which questionable is, given the acquisition by IBM, if that's going to be a thing. What else is out there? There's every
I
cloud that has
think
an option.
I think there is one password.
That is a SaaS, just like, secrets manager and
We've got Vault in use and Secrets Manager and SSM Parameter Manager. And in looking for a common place to go with all of them, I ran across the CSI Secrets provider, I guess, and basically provides a standard interface. My understanding of it, as I didn't get to do it, but yeah, I think it is the secret store, a standard disk-mounted, volume-based interface for all secrets from wherever they come from. I thought that was a pretty good option from the options that I looked at, though none of them really deep based.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I mean, this goes one of the things the this it's really interesting just to think why Kubernetes chose secrets to be something that you typically mount as files. And it's presumably for the argument of why environment variables are insecure on any sort of a shared system. So, but I don't know if Jonathan, you were talking about like a Kubernetes approach or just more general.
Either or, we do use Kubernetes or Kubernetes approach, but something like this with the CSI driver, you tend to end up what mounting these as a volume, and then that problem that we talked about with the secrets manager agent is still there, which is that any code that can kind of run nearby can grab all the secrets.
Well, I think the idea with the with these volumes is that it uses file system level permissions to restrict who can read from those. Obviously, if you have root access on the host, all bets are off. But with well, okay, yeah, and then within a given container, every process has the same permission, so it should be able to read the file. So yeah, I don't know, man.
It just feels like there are a lot of attempts scratching towards a better tomorrow or a better solution. But we actually use something like this with volume mounting, which I actually I'm not even sure I want to say, but because it does.